And good afternoon. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil. Can I make an announcement?
Let's make an announcement right now.
If you donated during the spring membership and or the new transmitter drive campaign, you should be receiving a tax receipt either by email or regular post within the next couple of weeks. Also, if you donated $85 or more and indicated you would like a new campaign T-shirt, you should be receiving that too. If you are expecting a tax, if you are expecting a T-shirt and or a tax receipt and do not receive it by July 21st, please let us know, and you can contact the membership office at 416-978-0909, extension 206, or by email. And thank you again for all of your support of CIUT and the new transmitter and for the Taylor Report.
Hey, thank you, Phil. Well, and also for Classical Underground at 6 p.m. on Wednesdays.
And yes, thank you very much for your support for that and for Friday morning at 9 o'clock, which is the best cultural show on radio in Toronto, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I attend that every week. It's religiously. Yeah. Now, it's the Taylor Report. We're going to talk today to the author Fred Jerome. He is the author of Einstein on Race and Racism, along with Roger Taylor. He is also the author of The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist. And another book, Einstein on Israel and Zionism, His Provocative Ideas About the Middle East. And I'll remind you, by the way, later in the show we'll be talking with Rick Rozoff of Stop NATO. And I urge you to go to that site. You can Google him, Stop NATO. But I think we're joined now by Fred Jerome. Are you there, Fred?
Yes, I am, Phil.
Well,
good to be here.
It's great to be talking to you. I know that today we want to talk about the recent passing of a wonderful actress and what they call an activist, Ruby Dee, who stood out and was courageous throughout her whole life and just an amazing story. We want to talk about her and, of course, her also her husband and comrade Ossie Davis, and of course, your encounters with them, and inevitably a bunch of other names, Lorraine Hansberry, Paul Robeson, we will come to that. But I want to first of all ask you. I know that all of these people we're going to talk about were anti-war. They were peace advocates. They were advocates for resolving the contradictions in society around race, religion, culture. And so it seems appropriate, and I know that you're one of such person, to ask you, given the fact that the United States seems at the moment to be extremely belligerent, your president has said that his country is indispensable, and they seem to be getting involved in issues in Iraq, Syria, Ukraine. How are you reacting to this, and what do you think is going on in the United States?
Well, what's happening today and this past week in the Middle East and Iraq and I think in the Ukraine also is really not that different from what this country's been doing for the last 50 or 60 years, except that it's trying to maintain, especially under the Obama administration, instead of facade of new liberalism. You know, we're not like that anymore. That was Bush. Those were the terrible Bushes.
Yes, Guantanamo and torture,
right,
and such. Yes.
And the truth is, it's very similar. You could almost say we're not out of the Bushes.
Yes.
But
right. I think I'm sorry. I'm slow on the uptick. Yes,
that's all right.
Yeah.
I mean, so what the sending of troops, of American troops, which hasn't really quite happened yet, or a few have gone, but and the bombings haven't fully happened yet in the Middle East, but it seems likely that it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the support for the questionable, at best, Ukrainian regime, I would say right wing, and other practices, particularly the deportation of immigrants from this country, which has been gone beyond any previous administration in American history, and recently recently reported, anyway, I'm not sure it's just recently, but recently reported the widespread detention of immigrant children to this country, so that you've got thousands, something like more than nearly 50,000 unaccompanied children who have come into the U.S. in the last 6 months or 8 months, since October of 2013.
And the conditions they're in are really quite noxious, right? I mean, things
right.
I hear.
They're putting them
to work. They're putting them in with adults and all kinds of things.
And they basically have what they call a placement center, which is a nice term for basically a concentration camp in Nogales. And I think there's another one, and there's two. One's in Brownsville, Texas, and one's in Nogales.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a picture in front of me of the U.S. military escorting these handcuffed children to the detention center. And so that's the latest.
My gosh. By the way, it sort of illustrates something that the answer to all American questions seems to involve the military.
I think so, yes. And I think it's important to say it's not just the military, because Obama, and I don't think Obama is worse than Bush was, but I'm not sure that he's any better than Bush was. I think that the President of the United States, the job of the President of the United States is to represent the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States has been and continues to be probably the biggest, I use the word imperialist, but certainly the colonizing and bombing and trying to be the policeman of the world for certain interests.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Obama's job, too.
By the way, Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report, has talked about this, and he says, you know, in terms of trying to stop the war, get a decent society, because of his policies, Obama's more difficult to cope with because he gets a pass, because the liberals all have decided he's okay. Had George Bush stood in front of the West Point and said, in every fiber of my being, I believe in American exceptionalism, all the Democrats would have been out in the streets saying, oh, look at that.
Right. I just read this one brief quote from Obama, which was last week on CNN. He was interviewed by Jim Acosta, and Acosta asked him why the U.S. was getting involved in Iraq. What was the national security interest of the U.S.? And Obama said, our interests are nothing less than to prevent an all-out civil war inside Iraq. Then he explained what he meant by that. This is what he meant by that. Not just for humanitarian reasons, but to promote regional stability, keep our allies strong, and protect global energy markets.
Ooh.
That's it. So I think
I think he got it backwards, didn't he?
Right, exactly.
Well, he's like a good comedian. He saved the punchline for last.
Right, exactly. But now, if Bush had said that, you know, everybody would be jumping up in it, but that's what he said. This was a week ago, and clearly that seems to be what they're doing, and the use of drones, the continued use of drones, which is justifying on the basis of, well, you can kill Americans with drones and so on. And an interesting little item was in the local paper here yesterday, which I don't think most people saw or heard of, even most people who read the local paper, because it was a very small item. It said that more than 400 U.S. military drones have fallen out of the sky since 2001, a staggering number of crashes that expose the pitfalls of opening up American airspace to the unmanned devices. These are accidents that have happened with the drones.
And amazing.
Amazing. More than 400.
Yeah.
And then it describes some of them. And in one case, because they're using them in this country to I don't know what they're doing, spying on people or whatever. But in one case, a 370-pound Army drone, I'm quoting from the paper, crashed beside an elementary school playground in Pennsylvania. But last April.
Yeah.
Only minutes after students had gone home for the day.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm just.
And of course, but national security trumps everything, right?
Right. Absolutely.
And so if you lose a bunch of children in the playground, well, that's the price of freedom.
Right. But I think that we're dealing with a continuing, but maybe getting worse, and certainly not as people are not as aware of it. And the other thing is, and this gets to probably the other part of our discussion, but that you don't see a lot of protests. You don't see a lot of people demonstrating.
No.
There was a very small demonstration last week. I mean, very small. And there may be another one planned this week, but it's not even clear that there's going to be one.
Oh, my gosh. Well, this is Fred Jerome. He's the author of Einstein on Race and Racism and the Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist, and Einstein on Israel and Zionism, His Provocative Ideas About the Middle East. And we want to talk about this Ruby Deeb and the whole phenomenon of racism in America, and particularly in American culture. And you walked into it at your father's apartment, 2nd Avenue, New York.
Right.
And there was a group of people in the room, and they said, tell us what that who those people were and why this is an important story. But
okay, I think it is important, and it's important to say, to start off by saying that my father and mother were communists, and that means that they believed in communism, and they talked about it, they were open and public about it, and they were members of the Communist Party. My father was one of more than 100 officials of the Communist Party in this country who were sent to jail in the 1950s, which very few people even know happened.
Yes.
And he served 3 years in the federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Some of the others served 5 years and so on.
Yeah, his field was culture, right?
His field was culture. And so during the 1950s, when many, many people were blacklisted, they were subpoenaed, they called before the committees, and if they refused to answer the committee's questions, if they refused to name names, they were blacklisted, especially in the labor movement, but also in the, you've heard of the Hollywood Ten, and so the cultural field got much more publicity when the people were blacklisted. And so what happened, because my father's field was culture, he and my mother would invite people over to the house who were blacklisted artists for the most part, would come over to the house on a Saturday night and just have a kind of a soiree. And someone would usually either read a chapter of a new play that he or she had written, or sometimes there'd be someone would sing or do poetry, and there'd be discussion and just a good time. And these were all people who were blacklisted. And in that group were Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee. And they were probably the two youngest, and I remember them because I was a teenager at the time, but I was probably closer to Ossie and Ruby's age than most of the other people there who were older.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were in that group, and that was because they were not going to testify. They refused to testify before the committee. And if you read their writing, Ossie Davis' book, one of the books is called In This Life Together, with Ossie and Ruby, In This Life Together. And he discusses at length the role of communists and his friendship and admiration for Paul Robeson and many others. And many of these people were at my parents' house. And I think I sent you some of the names, but...
Martha Schlammer.
Martha Schlammer, right.
Pete Seeger, Lee Hayes, Leon Bibb.
Right.
And, of course, in the center of all this is the man himself, Paul Robeson.
Absolutely.
Who, if there's any man who had to face public martyrdom, one of the greatest artists and athletes and scholar, he was everything.
That's right.
He wouldn't bow. He wouldn't bend his knee.
Right. And I've told people often, and sometimes when we speak speak, because in our book, Einstein and Race and Racism, the main, or one of the main things that we discuss is Einstein's friendship with Paul Robeson, which spanned a period of 20 years, and which nobody has written about except for our book, even since the book came out.
Yes.
And it's been reported, and some of the other things have been written about. Nobody's talked about Robeson.
There are library shelves groaning under the weight of biographies of Einstein, none of which contain a reference to Paul Robeson.
That's correct.
Which is to say, I mean, that's serious. Freud would be very interested in this.
Yes. Anyway, I tell people often that the luckiest thing that happened to me in my life, probably outside of meeting my wife, was having a chance to meet and talk with Paul Robeson.
Indeed. Well, and by the way, could you just physically describe what was going on in that? Do you remember him talking or what he was saying to them? I mean, by the way, he's looking at heroes, they're looking back at a hero. They're all facing a McCarthyism and agreeing not to bend or
make
a compromise.
And everyone who came to these sessions and knew, I mean, my parents had an apartment which was a fairly good-sized apartment, but it was a four-story walk-up, and they were steep, winding stairs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the kind of walk-up you would do if you had a choice of where to go on a Saturday night. But so people who came, besides the names that you mentioned and Ossie, there were people like Ben Robeson, Lorraine Hansberry, and
William Marshall,
exactly.
Playwright Ted Ward, Frank Silvera, and Phil Rose, the producer, and his wife, Doris, Belak?
Belak,
who people might know her from Law and Order.
Yes, right. And Phil Rose produced Raisin in the Sun on Broadway at a time when people said, and then he later wrote a book, that the title of the book is called You Can't Do That on Broadway, which is what people told him. And he did it, and he passed away a couple of years ago, but we were good friends of theirs, and really he was a very wonderful, warm person, as was his wife Doris.
Yeah, but they were just determined fighters against racism.
Yes.
I mean, his personal story I think he had a job once as a salesman where he went door to door in a black neighborhood, and he said he felt richer and richer in terms of his experience and appreciation of people doing that work.
Absolutely. And the thing about Phil was he didn't come from that background. Some of the other people had been involved on the left, you know, for a long time. Somebody like John Howard Lawson, one of the Hollywood Ten, who was over quite a bit, and Howard Da Silva, a name you may know if you follow.
Actually, I don't know Howard Da Silva.
He's been in a number of movies, so mm-hmm. I won't try to remember them all. But and another person who came sometimes with the others and sometimes separately was W.E.B. Du Bois. And I remember going to visit him as in Brooklyn at the time. He lived with his wife Shirley Graham in Brooklyn Heights,
mm-hmm.
but they would come over.
By the way, I've heard he was a man of small stature with a huge voice. Is that describing him?
I don't think his voice was huge in the sense of being booming.
Yeah.
It was a huge voice in terms of what he said. But it was
asking you.
It was a high pitched voice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this one, I think I may have told you this story, but when I was at City College some years later, or in the 1960s, no, it's still the end of the 1950s, we invited Du Bois to come and speak. And we figured it was hard to get people to come out to any meetings in the 1950s in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Silent Generation.
Mm-hmm.
And we were having trouble, and so we decided to invite Du Bois to speak, and we invited him to speak about black liberation. Black Reconstruction. Black
mm-hmm.
Reconstruction. He is the expert on black Reconstruction.
Absolutely.
So we got all these professors who knew that he was an expert on that to let their classes encourage their classes to go to the lecture and so on. We had about 400 or 500 people to come out to hear him.
Uh-huh.
And, I and a couple of other people drove out to Brooklyn to pick him up in his house. we were driving back to from his house with him to City College, and he's in the back seat, and he said to me, and I'll never forget this. That's why I say I remember his high pitched voice. He said, "By the way, what is it I'm supposed to be speaking about?" And we turned around. I said, "Well, Dr. Du Bois, we've been telling everybody you're going to speak about Black Reconstruction." "Oh dear," he said. "Oh dear. That's really not what I planned to speak about. I'm going to speak about socialism. I hope that's all right." He wasn't asking. He wasn't saying he was going to change. And I was, of course, it was fine with me. But it was, anyway, there's a lot more to the story. But
well, I wish I'd attended. And I know you didn't contradict him.
No, I learned a great deal from his speech, actually. It was a whole history of the world in the last 150 years.
Mm-hmm. But, well, that's a natural connection to the name Lorraine Hansberry.
Yes.
We had Raisin in the Sun is right now on Broadway.
I think it's just about to close. It's just about to close because we try to get tickets before it closed. But
it's been as big as ever. People are winning awards for their performance.
Absolutely.
And now, again, Lorraine Hansberry was a friend of W.E.B. Du Bois, of Paul Robeson.
And I
know I saw some notes. I hope you're working on a lot of detailed memoir, but I saw that you met her and regarded her as, I think you were smitten with her. Let's put it that way.
I was smitten with her, for sure. I was about 14 when I met her, and she might have been, 15 years older, or 10 or 12 years older. But, you know, when you're 14, anyway, whatever. But actually, there was a poetry contest that was a sort of a left-wing teenage poetry contest. And the judges were Paul Robeson and Lorraine Hansberry.
Oh, my gosh.
And they didn't know who the authors of the poems were. They just got the poems without any names, so they decided which poems. And my poem, I submitted a poem, and it won second prize in this contest. And I was so thrilled. that's when I first met Lorraine Hansberry.
Yeah. When she was recognizing that you were a great poet.
Exactly. And as I said, I would love to tell people about it, but I can hear people say, sure, you know, how many poems were there in the contest anyway? Two? And I couldn't really answer that, but in any case.
But there they were, Robeson and Lorraine Hansberry.
That's right, exactly. And it was clearly, and if you, I've been writing about Lorraine Hansberry, because in addition to everything else, I felt that besides being smitten with her, she actually, I think, had a lot to say, and if you go through her papers, which are in the Schoenberg Center Library in New York, you'll see that she writes a lot about her politics.
Mm-hmm.
She has a theory, and she was a communist.
Yes.
She says so. I mean, she has a series of letters called Notes from a Young Communist. That's her title.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about it. In fact, there's an interesting book, which I think your listener, this is the new book just out. It's called The Other Blacklist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by a woman named Mary Helen Washington.
The Other Blacklist, Mary Helen Washington.
And it's about the black people who were blacklisted in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time you hear about, you know, the Hollywood 10 and people like that, all these actors and actresses, and you very rarely hear about the African-American actors and writers and playwrights and so on who were blacklisted. And so there's some wonderful quotes from Lorraine Hansberry in that book.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I remember, you know, people like Frank Silvera, who was they're all actually mentioned in that book about the Other Blacklist.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Marshall, and there was a man named Dots Johnson who was in the Italian film, playing us, I can't remember, one of the neo-realistic Italian films that came out in the late 40s.
Yeah. By the way, I should mention, I came across in my research a story told by Ossie Davis that he had a secondary part alongside William Marshall in a play that Marshall hated, where he played DeLaude, it was called Green Pastures or something?
Yes, that's what it was.
Kind of a white fantasy of black people, I think.
Right.
But he's a minister condemning sin, and Ozzie Davis said he couldn't get motivated. He hated the part, but he said the way I got him motivated, I'd come up to him and whisper the names of people who had been denouncing Paul Robeson, and then he'd get mad.
Yes. Wow, that's interesting. No, but he actually, Phil Marshall talked about that play, that playing that role, and how horrible it was years later.
Uh-huh.
I heard him still denouncing it, you know. But it's really interesting, and Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee both were there. And to put the point is that people who came to the sessions in this apartment came because they knew that my parents represented the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
So they might not have been members of the party, but they were friendly to or sympathetic with or wanted to be part of a circle, you know, that was connected to the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, Robeson was, I don't know that he was actually a member of the Communist Party, I don't think he was, but he was very close,
mm-hmm.
and he was there at all of these sessions, and he would greet people and chat with them and talk with them and so on.
Yeah, and by the way, you quote Ossie Davis, a wonderful quote.
Yes.
Where he says, Paul Robeson was a reservoir, the sum of the black man's capacities, a great national black phenomenon that all of us flocked to behold, a hero to all, gigantic and available. And as with all heroes, the gift was one way. Paul gave and gave and gave, and we took and took and took. Paul was a banquet, a feast for all hungers, and we rated him, all of us, black folks, white folks, communists, liberals, artists, politicians, race leaders, labor leaders, we rated him. He gave because he had to, because he loved us, and he knew better than we the bottomlessness of our need and desperation. Isn't that beautiful?
It's beautiful. And it's one of the things we quote in our book, and when we talk about Robeson and Einstein, and I would urge people, if they haven't read this book, they're interested in the subject, that's mm-hmm. worth getting to Einstein and race and racism.
Well,
I don't say that because I was one of the authors, but just
because that's the only place you're going to find it.
Right.
Which takes us to another point. I mean, why did Albert Einstein find himself working with Du Bois and Robeson? Because nobody from the Democratic Party wanted anything to do with ending lynching in America, ending apartheid in America.
That's
nobody
right.
from the Republican Party wanted anything to do with it.
And in fact, Einstein,
you know, I always find this so amazing to be saying, oh, you know, maybe he was a communist, maybe, oh, he should be ashamed.
Yeah,
ashamed? No. The two ruling parties of America were holding up a racial segregated system by law.
Yeah,
law.
And when, in 1946, when Einstein and Robeson co-chaired a group called the American Crusade to End Lynching,
mm-hmm.
and they were the co-chairmen, and you can find this in Einstein's FBI file, maybe not too many other places, but it's discussed at length in the FBI file. And when they went to Washington, or Robeson and other group and others, including Du Bois, went to Washington to protest and demand that Truman and the Congress institute an anti-lynching law, which they never did.
Yes.
And Robeson and a few others met with Truman in the White House, and
mm-hmm.
Robeson criticized Truman, and Truman threw them out of the White House.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just an amazing story. Here's this,
yep.
this sort of liberal president that we hear about.
And not repeated very often, is it? And I mean,
no.
if we don't interview Fred Jerome of Einstein on race and racism, we would not hear that story.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, I think a lot of the reason I think it's important to talk about Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee and Lorraine Hansberry is because that. While they themselves were open about their politics and their beliefs, the historians who have come since then,
mm-hmm.
who are now telling us about what great people they were, never mentioned their politics. Or
yeah.
I shouldn't say never mentioned it. Ruby Dee, Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee's grandson, whose name I can't recall, is about to do a documentary about them
mm-hmm.
on television, at least in this country. And it's going to include excerpts from their FBI file.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's going to be limited in terms of how much politics get mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying the historians who tell us, all of them who tell us Einstein was this great thinker but never mentioned his politics, never mentioned yeah. the fact that he wrote an essay in 1949 called Why Socialism?
Yes.
and so on, do the same thing with most of these actors and actresses. And I think it's related to what we were talking about in the beginning, because the left wing, the communists and other people on the left, were key to organizing protests and demonstrations and marches and so on.
Yes, and they weren't loyal to and subservient to the two ruling parties.
Exactly, exactly right. And so today they are, unfortunately, and this has to do with things that have happened not just in this country, but probably around the world, including what was once the Soviet Union and so on and so forth, that unfortunately today we just don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And no, so the lack of protest around the oil wars in Iraq and wherever else Obama and the administration decide to bomb, which is they've already said now they're going to, when they bomb, they're not just going to limit the bombing to Iraq. It's clearly going to include Syria and who knows where else.
Yes, it's always we're going to sort them all out. It's going to be a big production, a Cecil B. DeMille production.
Right. In fact, there's a guy in Montreal, and you mentioned his name once.
I think it's Chalcedowski.
That's correct. And he was on the radio the other morning here in New York, Pacifica Network, and talking about the role of the U.S. in supporting both sides, or many sides, in this so-called war in the Middle East, because they want to set new borders for countries in the Middle East that are easier for them to control. So that would include Syria and Iraq and who knows what else.
Yes. Amazing.
Yeah.
But if you're the indispensable nation, an exception, you get to do that. It is a very scary situation. I wonder, Fred, if I can ask you one last thing about this and contextualize a bit. Well, this issue about the communists and their role. Now, in Europe, in fighting fascism, they really lost a lot of people, and they put their lives on the line and played a big... And it's appreciated in countries like Belgium, France, Italy, Greece. It's known and understood.
Absolutely.
And there are parties, and people say, well, I may vote for him, I may not. I like this, I don't like that. So-and-so is an actress and a communist, so what? Here, there's a pathology. It seems to me both Thomas Mann and Albert Einstein remarked on it.
Yes.
That there's something a little scary about this culture, which seems to is a hostile, intolerant, bigoted, politically bigoted culture, despite all talk about democracy.
I totally agree, but it's important to, it might be worth noting that Einstein made the point that one of the things that was scary to him about it was that it brought back brought memories of what happened in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he used it almost word for word. He said the Americans are trying to be like the Germans.
Yeah.
This was in a speech, I think, in 1949. I can't recall.
Well, that was, if you look at the famous Iron Curtain speech, to go on with a little discussion.
Yes.
Churchill said we need an Anglo-American alliance to dominate the world for the world's best interest. And he called it, he said, an alliance between America and the British Empire.
Right.
An Anglo-American. And he meant English language. And people of Eastern Europe responded to him by saying, actually, we heard this idea before.
Yes, interesting. Very interesting. In fact, we're doing a film. Maybe when it comes out, you might be interested. We got a grant to do a film based on our book, Einstein and Race and Racism, about Einstein and Robeson and their friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have initially a brief sort of trailer, a 10-minute trailer, but the gist of it, even of the trailer, is that the last time that the two men met in Einstein's house, Einstein had invited Robeson to visit him because Robeson had been under such heavy attack during the McCarthy period. And when Robeson came to see him in 1952, in October of 1952, Einstein was very depressed because of what was happening in this country, and it brought memories of Germany, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
And Robeson, on the other hand, who had been attacked and had lost any kind of income that he had a big income, lost that, and so was being barred from concert halls, was not depressed at all. He was very active. He had organized a concert. They wouldn't let him go to Canada. You may have heard this.
So
he, with the help of a Canadian union in the West Coast, they organized a, I think it was the mine mill.
Yes.
I'm not sure. They organized a concert where Robeson stood on the American side of the Peace Arch and sang across to Vancouver on the other side, and there are thousands of people cheering on the other side.
Yep. Well, we're still cheering.
Yes, well, and the effect of Robeson describing that and other things he was doing, he organized a newspaper, a theater in New York, and so on, the effect of that on Einstein was to actually cheer him up, encourage him, and he started speaking out much more boldly and actively against McCarthyism. In the next year, he was on the front page of the New York Times twice denouncing McCarthyism.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's a great story, Fred, and that's a good place for us to close, I think. Fred Jerome, Einstein on Race and Racism, The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War, Einstein on Israel and Zionism. Hey, thanks an awful lot, Fred. We want to talk to you more.
Thank you, Phil. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Oh, good. Good. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Fred Jerome, and his father did go to prison for 3 or 4 years. By the way, there are... You can go around the net and find these things. But Fred talked about being in high school and going on his first date and being followed by two FBI guys. So his girlfriend was very impressed. He says, watch this, we're going to lose him. And he gets on, does all the old subway tricks where, you know, the two guys are in the car with you, and then at the last moment you jump off. That's just like in the movies. But except it wasn't very, very pleasant.